Well, you've heard me talking about TrueCar now long enough, have you not? It is true cash offer from local TrueCar certified dealers. It takes nothing. It takes no time at all. You do it from your smartphone, your home. You just go to TrueCar. You enter your license plate number. You watch it. All the details pop up. You answer some questions. And then you get that accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It is that easy. Then you bring your car in, Uber home with your check, or if you want to trade in, lock in a price for a vehicle on TrueCar. You know it's a fair price because you see what's paid for that vehicle in your area. You know it's a true price because it includes fees and accessories. And you know it's for an actual vehicle on that TrueCar certified dealer's lot. So when you show up, you know that car is going to be there. You trade in and you leave with your new ride. And that can be a new or used vehicle, don't forget, from TrueCar with that true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. So when you are ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. And welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast, everybody. Be sure to keep the wind in the sails of the Corolla Pirate Ship and support the people that support us here. We do appreciate it. We try to select these people carefully, and we stand behind them. And I'm going to be at Caroline's on August 29th on Broadway, so we're going to do a live After Dark show. So come bring your questions. We'll watch some crazy videos. And Kat Timpf, Rich Voss will be helping me out. And a special meet and greet afterwards. If you go to doctor.com, you find the details there. It's my privilege to welcome my friend, philosopher warrior, Ryan Holiday. Hey, man.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So it's you helped out on always. The A&D show. How was that experience for you?
That's like a dream. I grew up listening to Love Line so long. I can't really wrap my head around it.
So that you were just with the both of us?
Yeah.
Well, some people that have that experience, you know, where they're Love Line fans, will just sit back and watch us.
That was a little bit, yeah.
That's so funny to me. And was it everything you imagined it would be?
Sure.
Yeah, good. So the new book is Stillness is the Key. You know, while we were doing A&D, I was thinking to myself, what do I want Ryan to write about next? Do you have an idea for your next book yet? Or are you already writing it?
I do. I don't want to say. I'll tell you off the air.
Okay. Because I was just – it's got to be something in response to the opposite of stoicism that we're seeing in the world today.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was thinking, how can you frame that?
Because I do think stillness is the opposite of the world today.
Well, stillness sort of – yes, but it also fills out your philosophical lexicon, right? Mm-hmm. Because it there's a lot of stillness, particularly in the Eastern philosophies and things, and you get into that more. And I was surprised how much was in the earlier philosophical lexicon too, like Pascal and these guys who came up a surprisingly amount in your book.
Yeah, I mean, 500 years ago, Pascal goes, all of humanity's problems stem from his inability to sit quietly in a room alone.
Isn't that crazy?
I'm like, yep, that's it. You nailed it.
You didn't mention, I didn't catch at least his wager in the book.
Yeah, you know, I should have.
Well,
done
I don't know about it, but I was reading it, I thought to myself, I wonder what Ryan's thought are about Pascal's wager.
Well, because I have a section in there on sort of higher power, and I'm talking about higher power more in from the angle of surrender. That so much of the problem of our world today is that we think we're the center of the universe. And in that way, we are all addicts. We are all like addicts, right?
Yep.
Even if we're not addicts, we look down, they make them accept a higher power. It's like, no, the idea is primarily admitting you're not number one.
Not that it's not number one, but that you're not in control.
Yes.
I mean, you're in control of you, but you're not in control of what happens, which is, again, a sort of a stoic principle.
Totally. And there's this humility in going like, I don't know how the universe works.
Oh,
I don't know.
Well, addicts have this strange – they always have this strange sense. There's two ways that they'll describe it to me. Like, I feel like the whole world's on my shoulders. But they really are trying to control everything. They're in control all the time. But the other piece of it is they feel like a piece of shit around which the whole world revolves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I talk about that in the book too. Like I say, you know, egomania and imposter syndrome are the exact same thing. You are obsessed with the idea that everyone is thinking about you.
No.
And no one is thinking about you.
That's right. It's
no
true.
One thinks you're a fraud. No one knows you exist.
No one cares.
Yeah. They're thinking about themselves. They are having the same – they are running the same insecure monologue in their head that you are doing.
Of course.
And if we could all let go, we could be present and enjoy each other and what our talents are, and we could have confidence. And so I do think Pascal's wager is interesting for people who don't know it. It's this idea like we don't know if God exists, but he might. And since he might, you should be a good person and more or less follow religious doctrine because the costs of being wrong are very, very high.
Right. He's wagering it all on the possibility.
Yes. And
given that the benefits are so fantastic yes. that it's worth the wager.
And I guess what the Stoics would say is they go like, you know, a Christian says like, don't do this because God says don't do this. Or they say don't do this because you'll go to hell if you do. I think the Stoics are basically saying, I think this is where I come down. They're like, don't be a bad person. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Don't steal because your life will be hell.
It's not a good life. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And so I guess the reason that Pascal's wager does not seem that much of a wager to me is like what you're saying is like hey, if you exercise and eat healthy, you might meet the woman of your dreams. It's true. You also will just feel better.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And so
right. So right. So you're just leading a good life. So what's wrong with that? It's a pretty good empiric process, even if the wager is not even there.
Yeah, like what are you really giving up? I mean,
right.
Provided that you think that being a good Christian or whatever is, you know, following the more reasonable principles in the Bible, it's not becoming some, extreme monk who whips
right.
themselves or, you know, as long as you're like, hey, like I'm going to love my neighbor and I'm going to follow the Ten Commandments. If that's what it takes to get into heaven, and so we're wagering like just, okay, but that means I can't kill anyone. I definitely can't kill my neighbor. You know, I have some obligations to my parents. These don't seem like that much, like enormous sacrifices.
Right. Although when I think about the wager itself, I think to myself, well, from my perspective, this life is everything.
Yes.
And if you're wagering that, you're wagering a lot
yes.
because you're wagering what the fullness and richness of this life on behalf of some notion of some something later.
Of course.
Now, the reality of that wager allows you to live a good life here, and that's
yes.
fine. So there's no consequence
yeah.
to the contrary.
Totally.
Let's take a quick call here. This guy's waiting a little while. And Ryan Holiday, of course, The Stillness is the Key of the Book. Matthew, go ahead.
Hey, Dr. Drew. Hey, Ryan. How are you guys doing?
Hey.
Drew, I'll make this quick because I know you've gotten it before. I remember even hearing someone ask it. I just can't remember your take on it.
Okay.
This is someone newly getting into to therapy. I'm going to start out with some CBT therapy.
Okay.
And just in general, where do you find the balance between trying to make sure you find the right fit and right person for you? Because I'm kind of worried that I'm going to just, you know, overthink it and you know, keep going, thinking maybe I should see someone else, or or just kind of sitting with someone and going through the process is maybe more key.
What are the issues? What are you trying to deal with?
A little bit with marijuana addiction, but then also just in terms of being more. Kind of a little bit like what you guys were saying with the imposter thing, just being able to be able to express myself better around people and to, I don't know, just not withhold as much and just be more open and work on just interpersonal relationships
all
as
right.
well.
So you're kind of an ideal candidate for CBT, really. I mean, everything you're talking about is evidence-based improved with CBT. So that should be good. Generally speaking, I advise people to look for a therapist with specific letters after their name, right? MD,
mm-hmm.
PhD, PsyD. So at least you know the level of training is at a level that you can really rely on the professionalism and the quality. Now, there are plenty of excellent MFTs and LCSWs. LCSWs particularly tend to make very good therapists. But in terms of you know, one of the sort of ways to approach finding a therapist is you first go to a psychiatrist, get a proper workup, get a diagnosis, and then you have that person refer you to the therapist that's best suited to the condition you've got. That's sort of the ideal way to do it. But in terms of what you're contending with, it sounds like you're like on the right track here. So stick with it. Don't second guess.
Okay.
They're going to talk to you about stopping the pot, though. You may not like that.
No, I know. I'm ready to hear it. I'm at the point you always talk about where I'm just kind of over it, and I've actually significantly cut back. But
good.
I know in time I'm going to probably end up cutting it out completely.
That may be all you need to do. Frankly, a lot of stuff may
exactly.
take care of itself.
I just kind of want to fast track it so I'm not here in my mid 40s saying the same stuff. So.
Yeah, good for you. All right, man. Good luck, Matthew.
All right. Thank you very much. Take care. Have a good night.
Bye bye. So let's go back to the various books and the philosophies you're following. The Silicon Valley guys seem to have picked up your stuff, right?
Yeah.
Does that surprise you?
No. I mean, Stoicism seems to be this philosophy that is popular with extremely powerful and extremely powerless people. And the idea that Silicon Valley wouldn't be filled with people of both types.
Isn't that interesting? I would not have picked.
Do you know what I mean? Marcus Aurelius,
said,
the emperor,
yeah.
Epictetus, the slave,
yeah,
everyone in between.
There you go. And I've always said that the very rich and the very poor have much more in common with each other than with the rest of us. It's a weird thing. When I first started working at psychiatric hospital, that was all that was there, the very poor and the very rich. I thought, wow, same conditions too in both populations.
Yeah, and I think in Silicon Valley, particularly with the people who are doing well, is you're it's like on Maslow's hierarchy, all the stuff is taken care of. You thought you'd be happy when you were successful. You thought you'd be happy when you were important. You thought you'd be happy when you sold the first company and you proved everyone who doubted you for dropping out of college, blah, 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 blah. You thought you'd suddenly be great with women. You know, you thought all these things, and then you're like, oh, I'm still the same guy. Life sucks, you know?
Do you hear that from them, or do they sort of – gradually feel the satisfaction of those successes, but they never really get where they keep dropping back, or they never get where they want to go?
I think you just wake up one day. I don't think it's just like epiphany. I'm not a big believer in epiphanies.
Yeah.
I think the reason they've made their way to my books or they've started doing these things is they're just searching.
Yeah.
You know, like Walker Percy would say, to not be onto the search is to be in despair.
Right.
And he's this sort of great Stoic novelist. And I think what he was saying is like, if you have to wake up and go, this is it, that's bad.
Yeah.
So if you can go, if you're like, hey, I'm going to pick up a book, I'm going to listen to a podcast, I'm going to do this challenge, I'm going to follow this Instagram account, you're it's easier than admitting, hey, none of this has any meaning for me. And it starts to put you on a path. And then, yeah, maybe you start taking a cold shower or you start quoting things. But again, and I was actually just – while I was sitting here, I was emailing this journalist who was writing me just then about, you know, this trend. I was like, I don't think anyone is upset by this trend except for journalists.
Which trend?
The trend of – she was like, what does it say that these middle class to upper middle class, mostly white guys, are reading a philosophy – that talks to them about accepting the hardships of life, you know, or that talks about, you know, tolerating the status quo rather than being an activist who tries to change it. And I was like, look, of all the things these people could be doing,
tolerating the status quo.
Of all these things people could be doing, this is the least bad possible thing. And I was saying, like, I don't think any real people are upset by this, but it's also just a preposterous notion that Stoicism is about accepting the status quo.
I mean, was going to say, what does that have to do with Stoicism?
George Washington's favorite philosophy is Stoicism. This is not a guy who was like, oh, I like the status quo.
Right.
This is a guy who –
stay with the crown. No big deal.
Right. This is a guy who creates the nation we currently live in because he was a deep believer in human agency. But you can have a deep belief in human agency and accept and acknowledge the complete powerlessness of humans over so many things in the world.
And are these white guys? I mean, Silicon Valley is a big mix.
Well, you know, if you're a journalist trying to sort of whip up outrage, the idea that a guy from Latvia and a guy from Asia and, you know, a guy from Finland, a guy from England, and then a guy from Ohio, these are all white guys to you, even though that's actually an incredibly diverse list of human beings.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we live in a world where, strangely, race has suddenly become very important.
Oh, my God. Now I'm dying to know what your next book's going to be. I can tell you've been thinking about this stuff. I can tell. What can you tell me without divulging too much?
No, it has nothing to do with that. I don't want to touch that with a 10,000.
No, no, I don't mean race so much, but as this sort of lumping and whipping up outrage and
Yeah, I mean, I it is strange, like, to go to that point. I think it is, like, I remember being a kid. Now I'm probably sounding a little bit like Adam. But I remember being a kid, the whole idea was, like, race was not important. And I realized that, and gender was not important. And I realized that that idea also tolerated, like, in even my own life, I've seen horrible things tolerated by society, whether, you know, it's the Harvey Weinsteins of the world or whatever. So I'm not saying it was perfect, but I thought progress was race becoming less important. I don't understand why race is now the thing that I hear about all the time. Like, I was at this political thing yesterday, and a guy got up and he had to say, he was like, look, like, I'd love to vote for a Democrat. I'm a white guy. It seems like the party is not only not speaking to me, is speaking to everyone but me, and I'm the enemy. Yeah. You know, he's like, what does that mean? And I was just like, how sad is that question that, like, the idea of white people as an interest group has now been created almost because we've so focused on everyone else's identity when really, again, all this shit is made up. Like, black people are just slightly more tanned white people. Like, we're all exactly the fucking same. And that's what, to me, progress is moving towards, that idea that people are people. Marcus Aurelius, like, I love the idea that Marcus Aurelius is quoting this slave, this old slave in
Epictetus.
His book. Yeah, that people are people. And that's where we should be moving. But instead, we seem to be moving towards the opposite
tribes.
Of that.
Towards yes. Tribes. And so how has going so deep into all this stuff affected your life?
I mean, in on a sort of practical character level, it's like, oh, this is what you should do. This is what you should not do. I feel like it's made me a better person, better father.
So you make better choices.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, at the very least, I'm even conscious of the choices. Like, the idea yeah. that, like, the choices matter. And
is it as simple as trying to do the right thing?
Yeah.
At all times?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I keep a coin in my pocket and it has a quote from Marcus Aurelius on it, and he says, just that you do the right thing, the rest doesn't matter. Like, and I love that idea because to the Stoic, like, sure, yes, you want to bring about outcomes that change in the world. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you, like they say in football, like, the score takes care of itself. All you can do is play well and score points. You can't you can't control the refs. You can't control the weather. You can't control if someone gets hurt. You really can only control whether you're blocking the guy that you're assigned to block.
Like, right.
That's our level of – and so the Stoic is like, look, you're just going to do the right thing. And it's not consequences be damned, but it's certainly negative consequences to yourself be damned. Like, you're not going to let the fact that people are going to hate you for saying the truth stop you from saying the truth.
But that's to your point. The other coin that I look at every day is the one about fate, not just
Mor fati.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, totally. I mean, that's I think they're part and parcel of the same thing. It's like,
well, not in my head. One is living a certain kind of life.
Yes,
and the other is dealing with a certain kind of life.
Yeah, I just mean, like, so Amor Fati on the front of that coin, and Amor Fati is A-M-O-R space F-A-T-I. And it just means you love everything that happens.
Love
you
fate.
Embrace
love
you
fate.
Love fate.
Yeah.
And the image there is deliberate. It's a fire, because Marcus Aurelius was saying what you throw in front of a fire is fuel for the fire. So, like, people go, oh, the world is so awful. It's so unfair, you know, or things are so hard. And the Stoic would be like, yes, but this is all an opportunity to do the right thing. Like, this is like, it's shitty times make for heroes, right? I'm not saying I'm a hero, but the Stoics are just saying, like, you it is what it is. So you got to be who you have to be.
And the actual statement is not just to tolerate fate, but to love it?
Yeah, Nietzsche is the one who coins Amor Fati. He's not a Stoic, but he's sort of interested in Stoicism. But yeah, he says, not merely to bear what is necessary or what happens, but to love it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just, okay, this is what happened, but it's like, this is it.
To
nothing
me,
else.
I didn't realize that was a Nietzschean statement. Yes. But for him, that must go to his eternal recurrence theme,
yeah,
which is that live your life in such a way that if this was just lived over and over and over again eternally, it would be perfect.
Yeah, I think that's right, because maybe that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
We don't know. And so there's a certain kind of just both humility but also empowerment in the idea of, like, I'm just going to do what I'm going to do, and I'm going to try to live by kind of a code or a standard of behavior, It doesn't matter if people don't appreciate it. It doesn't matter if I'm hated for it. It doesn't matter if everyone else is getting away with doing the opposite, you know?
Because you know. You mentioned shitty times make for heroes. That makes me think immediately about Grant,
yes,
who is your hero.
It's one of yours too, right?
Well, it became as a result of one biography I wrote, yeah, read, and you read a bunch of them. So talk to me a little about his stoicism.
I just love Grant as this human being. I mean, he has this sort of shitty father who's always getting into trouble. He's this big personality, and he has this like really quiet mother. And Grant sort of is like, I'm not going to be like that guy. I'm going to be a sort of, no one thought he was a star. He barely makes it into West Point. He shows up there and he's like, this, I'd rather die than go here. But he guts it out. He comes out as a pretty decent student. He makes his way through the army, sort of struggles with alcoholism. The outbreak of the Civil War basically has this guy selling firewood by the side of the road.
He did well in the Mexican-American War, though.
Yes,
there's all kinds of reports of him as a horseman and having zero fear under fire.
Which makes the selling firewood by the side of the road almost more painful, right?
It's he just fell apart after that. And I don't know if it was PTSD or what, but he just did not do well after he served.
I mean, there's a line from Grant in his memoirs where he basically goes, he's like, the Civil War was the greatest reason a war was ever fought. And he's like, the Mexican-American War might be the worst reason a war was ever fought, at least in America.
And by the way, just for a little historical context, I didn't realize until I read his biography, we took over Mexico City. We went all the way, and Grant was the guy that took over the city.
Yeah.
He was in charge.
We were basically just a complete, utterly unjustifiable war of conquest,
right,
for the expansion of slavery.
Or not really that clear, but it was President Van Buren?
I think it's Polk.
Polk? Was it Polk?
Or Polk or Pierce?
It was Polk. You're right. It might have been Pierce. You're right. But Lincoln had a very famous – it was Polk because he had kept going at Polk when he was in the Congress kept submitting these spot resolutions. Show me the spot where American blood,
yes,
was spilled to justify the Mexican-American War, which there, of course, never was one.
My favorite Grant story, this is sort of around the firewood time. So this guy is like at rock bottom. It's like you graduate from Harvard and now you're working at a gas station.
Yeah.
That's like this fall.
Yeah.
And so Grant had always been opposed to slavery. His father was opposed to slavery. And then his wife, Grant's wife, inherits a slave. And Grant is trying to carve this farm out of like the worst, you know, just garbage ground.
Is in Missouri.
By himself, backbreaking labor.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine clearing a field with no tractor.
Yeah.
Like you're ripping stumps out with a horse. You're cutting the trees out. This is what Grant's doing. And all of a sudden, he inherits a slave. He's opposed to slavery. And now he has a free slave. It's like he didn't enslave this person, right? He didn't. But he also did, and he didn't ask for it. But here he is, this gift, right? And so he could make this guy do all this work he doesn't want to do. He could sell this guy and get money to pay someone to do all this work that's literally killing him. That, again, this is like a Harvard-trained guy. I mean, West Point guy, he shouldn't be clearing fields and selling firewood. And Grant just gives the guy his freedom. And this idea of like do the right thing, damn the consequences, like – it's easy to say slavery is wrong, and to say that it's inexcusable and no human should. But imagine if in today's dollar you're handed something worth $250,000,
right,
and it's part of a system that is legal, and yes, you're opposed to it. But that was before you would benefit from it in any way, when it would literally – it might even save your life.
And the conventional wisdom – he was living in Missouri.
Yes.
These folks are better off in this position.
Yeah.
We take care of them, blah, blah, blah. All that nonsense.
Yeah.
That was sort of how they justified – some of them justified it to themselves.
These would all – like, you know, there's that saying from Upton Sinclair. It's hard to convince someone of something that their salary depends on them not
under. Right.
It's – Here, his beliefs are challenged by what he desperately needs and probably wants, and he does the right thing. And I don't think he's explicitly a stoic, but like that's what character looks like, you know. And so I just find it so interesting that in history class, you know, you have kids not that far removed from high school. they probably learned that Grant was a drunk. Yeah. That Grant's,
bloodlust during the war,
or that Grant's administration was corrupt
and
that,
all kinds
that
of controversy.
They betrayed Reconstruction. Yeah. What they didn't learn was like character. And real character in the real world looks like. And to me, that just encapsulates everything that's wrong with education.
Also, Chernow really just looked at things carefully again.
Yes.
And the what would you call it? The journalistic excess.
Yes.
That covered him. It's much like nonsense that goes on today.
Sure.
You know, the people just get these outrages over stuff. That was an outrage time too.
Yeah, right. Imagine if history in 150 years was written by like people reading blog posts and tweets from today, how quickly you could get a false impression of things.
Right.
The other thing I loved about that Grant book is – and I think it's another thing we should have learned in school – is like I got the sense that like we won the Civil War and this is what I'd always thought from what I learned in school. We won the Civil War, but we didn't actually care about black people. And so we just betrayed them after the war. We got almost there and we just betrayed them. What Chernow does an amazing job showing is how valiantly and how heroically Grant and other Republicans fought to not only to pass the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment to make this country fair. And just the insane resistance that they got and how close they got to getting there.
Ugh.
And so it's like I think about like what should we teach kids? Should we teach kids that it was hopeless and screwed and it was another time of America falling short? Or should we say for all of our history we have been fighting to do the right thing against insane resistance and we almost get there and we almost get there and eventually we get there and then we have to keep going and going and going. And to me, that's also stoicism.
We never get all the way there. Editude, they make these unbelievable sheets. That's right, they're feathery soft. They feel like you're in a cocoon. Someone described it as being cocooned by a zillion kittens. They make other cotton sheets feel like sandpaper. And an editor at Goop said she and her boyfriend have not needed melatonin since their first sleep on the Editude sheets. Again, it is spelled Etitude. They're antimicrobial. They're organic bamboo Lysol. Recycles 98% of the water it uses. So it's one of the most sustainable beddings available. Cotton uses, of course, a lot of pesticides and they waste water, but not when they make the bamboo. And this is all made of organic bamboo Lyocell. It's extremely breathable. It regulates your temperature to improve your quality of sleep. Editude sheets, they are soft as silk, breathable as linen, but at the price of cotton. You're going to love them. And when you support our sponsors, you support our show. Right now, my listeners will get 20% off their sheet set and free shipping. Just text the word, well, my name, Drew, to 474747. The only way to get that 20% discount off your set of Editude sheets and free shipping is to text Drew, D-R-E-W, to 474747. Again, D-R-E-W to 474747. Messages and data rates may apply, but that's how you get that 20% off and the free shipping. Attention, true crime fans. Check out 22 Hours, An American Nightmare on Podcast One. It was a case that nightmares are made of. A family is held hostage for nearly 24 hours and murdered inside their own home. WTOP examines the complicated trail of evidence that police say led to finding their killer and why they say he committed such a brutal crime. Download new episodes of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare on Apple Podcast and Podcast One. LaCroix Sparkling Water. That's right. It was developed to give a health-conscious consumer refreshment flavor sparkle with an innocent twist of zero calories. That's right. Zero sweeteners, zero sodium. You can enjoy LaCroix. I like LaCroix a lot. They're sparkling water. It's calorie sweetener, sodium innocent, they call it, beverage with nothing artificial going on. LaCroix is a healthier alternative for you. It's available nationwide. And for a full list of retailers, visit LaCroixWater.com, LaCroixWater.com. You all know LaCroix. Everyone's got some of this. They're great flavors. The newest, hibiscus, that's right. Things like passion fruit, peach pear. Also, their so-called Curatape flavors, cerise lemon, kiwi sandaya. There's a lot of creative stuff in LaCroix, and it tastes great. It is great, and it's good for you. LaCroix Sparkling Waters and LaCroix Curate Sparkling Waters are gluten-free, vegan, kosher, and non-GMO. Whole30 approved and environmentally friendly. LaCroix cans are perpetually sustainable and recyclable. Check it out for more information. LaCroix Community on social at LaCroix Water. Again, of course, it's spelled L-A-C-R-O-I-X CROIX, or check them out at LaCroixWater.com. And that whole book taught me about Reconstruction. I thought I understood it. Oh my God, the violent! I really feel like Reconstruction was the most violent period against African Americans. It made slavery sort of a different issue.
Yeah, because they weren't just trying to kill black people. Black people were property, and then they were like, oh, let's just murder them all.
But through marauding leftover Confederate soldiers, which were gangs of war gangs, essentially. They just walked around killing people.
Yeah.
Frederick Douglass said, we gave up the lash for the shotgun.
Yes.
And that's exactly what happened.
It was horrendous.
For Jim Crow. And it was just, oh my God, that history is just – I think it was so traumatic we've turned away from it. Like we have not examined it properly yet.
Yeah. And look, this is something to nerd out about the Civil War that Grant and Sherman don't get credit for. We think like, we don't quite understand how – what Lincoln wanted – Lincoln had a much better plan for Reconstruction. Sherman and Grant had a much better plan for Reconstruction. The assassination of Abraham Lincoln, it's not just the tragic death of a president. It was the act of an insurgent terrorist, which set off like a two-decade wave of violence and lawlessness in this country.
Yes.
It may be the most effective act of political terrorism that you can think of, like on the scale of 9/11.
Yes,
because
the whole time they were afraid of reigniting another civil war. That's what they thought they were going to deal with.
And when we accepted Robert E. Lee's surrender, and where you have to give Robert E. Lee some credit. Is Robert E. Lee was worried about that happening. And so the idea of surrendering the army, ending the war, not dispersing these people as – you know, the army could have just melted off into the woods in the way that we saw in like a Vietnam or something where you're just putting down an insurgent. What happened in Iraq could have happened in the United States, and the danger of a war is that it doesn't end.
Right.
And it did end. But then it really didn't end, and there was this horrible period of violence and awfulness.
And what I didn't understand was these – what do we call them? These gangs of war – of Confederates?
They're like warlords.
Warlords, yeah. Became the KKK.
Yes.
That's where that came from.
You want to know an interesting Civil War Stoicism connection?
Yeah.
So one of the first translators of Epictetus into like American English, like publishing him in America, was a guy named Thomas Wentworth Higginson.
Sounds Southern.
No. He raises a black regiment of troops in New England and leads them into battle in the Civil War.
Oh, the movie was about that kid, right?
It's not about that guy, but it's the same story. The same story of glory. You have a Stoic leader. And so again, this idea that Stoicism is about resignation and acceptance and not about human agency or doing the right thing for people who are abused or disenfranchised is just preposterous.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. Do you read Marcus Aurelius on a regular basis still, or you get something out of that?
All the time. Yeah. I mean, I have the benefit of writing about it, so I'm always referring to it. But I'm always just – it's like a Bible where you're just sort of going, and I'm going to read this for a little bit and
When you were doing the Partially Examined Live, by the way, I interviewed Mark and Wes on this podcast.
You love that podcast.
I love that podcast.
Yeah.
It really, really filled out my philosophical understanding because I was sort of – been a dilettante all the time. But these guys converse about it in a way that's like being in a great symposium on the great philosophers.
I think it was a three-hour interview.
Yeah. They go for hours.
Wes Allman,
yeah.
288.
288.
288, sorry.
Yeah, that's what I said. Okay. 288. But I believe they were getting on you also when you did their podcast about the aside from the fact that Seth was bothered by accepting tragedy.
Yes.
There was also a problem about the philosophical enterprise of Stoicism. It doesn't really fit a typical philosophical enterprise. It doesn't have a philosophical structure to it.
And I think that's a good thing because when most people hear philosophy, they think, I don't have time for that. You know, they think like – what? Like, I don't want this like complicated explanation of the universe. I don't want and look, there
stay away from Heidegger.
Yeah, there is in Stoicism. Some of the Stoics talk about physics and they talk about all these things, but really the core Stoic text, when you look at like Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, Epictetus, it's just life advice.
Right.
It's like how to live in the world, how to be a good person in the world, how to bounce back from adversity, how to conquer your temper. I mean, like Seneca is just writing letters to his friend, or he's writing, you know, he's Nero's tutor, which is a complicated, you know, position. But like some of his things are just like basically lesson plans for Nero. He's like, he writes this essay of anger, which is like a really timeless essay about how powerful, important people have to be in control of their temper because the stakes are so high. And so Epictetus is a slave. We don't even know if he could write. You know, his
stuff was written down by a student.
Yes, this is like if you were a lecturer and you were I just observed your class for 6 months and I was like, these are the things that Dr. Drew says
some
are
notes.
Important.
Here are some notes.
Yeah. Like a student asked him about this. Here was his answer.
Yeah.
And then I didn't put the question. I
right.
just said this
right.
is what Dr. Drew said.
Right.
You know, you would get a pretty expansive picture about what you thought, but there would be contradictions. There would be
things would change over time.
Omissions.
Yeah.
But it would probably be much more helpful to people than some systemic explanation about the universe.
Right.
And what I think is interesting is there is pretty strong evidence that Hadrian, who's the emperor, two emperors before Marcus Aurelius, he's the one
– Hadrian's tomb.
Yes. Hadrian chooses a man named Antoninus Pius to be his successor on the condition that Marcus Aurelius is adopted in turn by this guy. So he knew Marcus Aurelius but was not like – anyways. there's pretty strong evidence that Hadrian attended Epictetus' lectures.
Oh, wow.
He was the emperor who spent more time in Greece than in Rome. He traveled the empire. He basically sort of turned it from a country of provinces to an empire with this endless travel. But again, just the idea that the most powerful man in the world is stopping in the philosophy classes of a former slave.
But in a way, the philosophy of the time was like talking to a great scientist or something.
Yes.
It's how's the world work? What's going on? What's your insights?
Well, yeah, just you go back and you're like, oh, people have never thought about this before.
Right.
Like when you go like, was Aristotle really that smart or was he just early? Like no,
he was smart.
No, but you know what? Like,
and he was early.
He was,
although the pre-Socratics had a lot of stuff worked out that we just have lost track of.
I just mean it's like if nobody's ever written any of this shit down before, the first guy that does it seems like a genius.
Yeah. That's true. Although I thought he was a pretty clear thinker.
Yes, of course. I just mean like that's how he's also a scientist and a biologist and a philosopher and
a
doctor. It's like
because
there wasn't that like.
There weren't separate disciplines.
Yes.
It was all philosophy.
Yeah. It's just like you're smart. You read books. Most people don't.
Right. You're a learned man.
Yeah.
And was there a relationship with the sort of religious elements? I could never figure that out with Stoicism.
I think it's a little of both. I mean there is like this weird some interesting overlaps with Christianity and Stoicism. Number one, Seneca and Jesus born in the same year.
Ooh.
Walked the earth at the same time.
I did not know that.
Both find painful ends at the hands of the empire.
Oof.
You know, both appear in Tacitus, right? Tacitus talks about this guy, Christus, in Jerusalem who's killed by the Jews. And then he's like, and then a couple years later, let me tell you about the death of this Seneca guy. You know, like these are historical figures, something in the water that this is all happening at the same time. Seneca's brother, a guy named Gaio, it's not his real name, he changed his name, but appears in the Bible because he's lenient in the prosecution of St. Paul.
Oh, interesting.
So like to the Romans, in Marcus Aurelius and Seneca's time, Christianity is not the powerful faith. It's these rabble-rousers who are getting in legal trouble all the time, and the Romans are the governors of these far-flung provinces.
These hippies.
Yeah, these disruptors. And so I just think that's really interesting. There's also a conversation with a Stoic philosopher at some point in the Bible, and then there is a fake letter. We're pretty sure it's fake, but it's a fake letter between like Seneca and St. Paul that some Christian made up in the like, you know, 300 AD.
Seneca's your favorite Stoic?
I like Marcus Aurelius most, and then Seneca I think is the most relatable because he's the man of the world with a complicated day job. You know, he's ambitious. He's hypocritical. you know, all these things.
I was explaining to my son the other day that, you know, this country was founded more on notions of the Roman Republic than Greece. Athens became a focus of our affection in the 20th century, really.
I got a book for you to read. It's called Cincinnatus.
Yeah.
And it's a biography of Washington and the founders from the perspective of, like, who they – like, exactly as you said.
Who they thought they were.
He basically says in this one point in the book, and I love this sentence. I think about it all the time. He's like, Washington accepted his commission in the Continental Army almost with the purpose of setting it down.
Yeah.
To him, the real theatrics, the real glory was not in winning the battles, not in accumulating the power. It was, could a man give it up willingly? Mm. Because his hero was Cincinnatus. There's this Roman general who's called as a dictator. Like in Roman times, an emergency, they would name someone dictator. And Cincinnatus is named dictator. And then at the end of the war, he's the greatest, most, you know, beloved man in Rome. He says, I want to return to my farm. And this is what he does.
Yeah.
And so George Washington, because he's so inspired by this, by Roman life, by Stoicism specifically, which he's introduced to as like a 16-year-old, not unlike our conversation. Someone's like, hey, you should read this book. And by the way, Washington's like the only founder who can only read the Stoics in English. Like – Jefferson and Adams and the other ones, they can read the Stoics in Latin or Greek or French.
Oh my God, how crazy.
Jefferson has Seneca in French on his nightstand. That's we forget how smart these fucking guys were.
Right.
Anyways.
You're referring to us meeting when you were 18 and me saying I was reading Epictetus.
But so Washington is modeling in everything he does what he thinks the Stoics would do. And to them, like the reason Stoicism was so popular, the most popular play in the world at this time is a play called Cato. And it's a play about Cato the Stoic. It's ironically like the Hamilton of its day.
Oh, wow.
Right? Like
was Cato – I didn't know he was a Stoic.
Yeah, Cato is the towering Stoic philosopher.
Oh. I never read his stuff.
We'll talk lots about Cato in a second then. But so there's all these, like a lot of the most famous lines in the American Revolution are from this play.
Really?
So give me liberty or give me death.
It's from that play?
Yes. I regret that I only have one life to give for my country. These are cribbed lines.
I thought they came out of their heads.
No. It makes it more beautiful, right? And then not only does Washington put on this play at Valley Forge, but his favorite line from the play is he says, things in the calm light of mild philosophy. Basically, like, I'm going to put things up to the test. I'm not going to react emotionally. I'm going to put them up for review. And over again, he just quotes it. Like, there's one two-week streak in, like, 1787 where there's, like, five letters from Washington with the same quote in it. The greatest moment in American history that nobody knows about is after the war, we don't pay the veterans.
Like, right. Oh, this is the blindness thing.
We basically screw them over.
Yeah.
And Washington, they are planning to essentially lead a coup. Congress.
There was an uprising that he addressed. There was insurrection.
The America as we know, it's about to end.
Yeah.
Washington hears about it and he's like, okay, I'll fix this. And he goes and he walks and he surprised. They don't know. He knows where they are. He walks into the meeting. And he confronts them about this. And it's this wonderful theatrical moment. For instance, he shows how old he is. He brings out his I have to put on glasses.
He's
worn out
a letter
my eyes.
From Jefferson or something, or from somebody.
Or maybe that he wrote.
Yeah, or he wrote. Okay.
But he just basically shames these men because they see how much this of all the people who haven't been paid.
I know the quote. Yeah. He says, I have not just gotten old in the service of my country. I'm afraid I've also gone blind.
Yes.
And they just
– And you know what he says a few minutes later? He says, I urge you to put your feelings in the calm light of mild philosophy.
Wow.
He says, think about what you're about to do. Do you understand this? You know, don't react emotionally. And he saves this country like a fourth time. And so, again, I get so angry when people say stoicism is about resignation. Like, this is a guy who his sense of stoic duty repeatedly sends him into the breach over and over and over again. Can I do one more Washington story?
Of course.
All right. So this is another great one. So Washington, early on in the war, the British troops are marching towards Mount Vernon, and an overseer rushes out. Do you understand? This is George Washington's house. Please don't destroy it. And back then, you know, they had these ridiculous like rules of battle.
Yeah,
you know, it was like this gentlemanly thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And Washington finds out that this guy asked for special treatment on his behalf.
Yes.
And he goes, I would rather my farm burn to the ground and I lose everything I ever loved, like including my family, than to be given special treatment on the account of who I am.
Yes.
Again, this is not a philosophy of resignation. This is a philosophy of like extreme personal
responsibility. It's like John McCain at Hanoi Hilton.
Of course.
Same thing.
Yes.
Exact same thing, strangely.
Yeah, and so
I mean, special treatment.
We need to bring these stories instead of just talking about how Thomas Jefferson was a hypocrite for owning slaves. We should talk about how Washington was the only founder who gave up his slaves, and we should talk.
But he
about,
kept them through his lifetime, though.
What, do you know why? Because he didn't own them; they were his wife's slaves.
Right, they're Martha's, right?
But it, and there's another thing. We don't again. We can't understand history. We don't understand how complicated these things are. What Virginia does, like, we don't understand that basically slave owners had this country by the balls.
Oh yeah,
they used the fact that their slaves counted as votes in Congress to pass insane laws in this country. But anyways, in Virginia, partially related to what we're just talking about, not only they couldn't stop someone from freeing their slaves, but they knew if everyone was freeing their slaves and you could be pressured into freeing your slaves, like the system would not last very long. So if you wanted to free your slaves, you had to pay a pension for them, so you couldn't just let them go. It kind of makes sense because you had
to cover them.
Yeah, but you had to cover them. So it was enormously expensive in terms of cash to pay for – you're not only not selling them, you have to – basically pay back so much of what you've earned. And so Washington, it's not just that Washington lets his slaves free. He's the only founder who's financially responsible enough, who believes in the right thing enough that he saves and puts aside the money so they actually can be free.
It
doesn't excuse the horrible abuse
that was
slavery, but we should be talking about how did a guy do the right thing when pretty much did close to the right thing when everyone else is doing the wrong thing? And we should be learning from these examples, not just – because when you just tear everything down and you make everyone look like a horrible hypocrite, all you're left with is nihilism and despair.
I'm afraid that's what some people want.
I think that is what they want. And then somehow that gives them an excuse to be more nihilistic and despair more. It's absurd.
Well, Blinkist is really unique. It works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser, takes the best key takeaways, that just need to know information from thousands of nonfiction books. It condenses them down to just 15 minutes so you can listen to them. It's amazing. I mean, I have limited time out there and I'm always trying to expand what I know. Learning is a lifelong process and Blinkist is a great way to keep that going. Now with Blinkist, you can get unlimited access to read or listen to their massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all the books you want, all at one low price. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has that special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist, Blinkist.com/Drew to start your free 7-day trial. Think about that. 7 days free. It's ridiculous. Do it. Blinkist, spelled Blinkist. Blinkist.com/Drew to start your free 7-day trial. Again, condenses all that information down to just 15 minutes. I don't know about you, but those nonfiction books are loaded with info. And if I can get out the key nuggets, that's what I want. Things like The Power of Habits, Fire and Fury, Emotional Intelligence, all of it. Check it out at Blinkist.com/Drew. All right. Now I want to touch on a subject that gets way too much negative press. That is so-called ED, erectile dysfunction. Even the way some of the companies that offer ED solutions, they tend to talk about the condition, leaving people feeling ashamed or embarrassed. The truth is, 30 million men plus are affected by some form of ED, and in the majority of cases, the cause is beyond their control. Of course, it is biological. What's even more devastating is that every case of erectile dysfunction really affects two people, right? It affects the male and his partner. The stress and strain that puts on the relationship can be damaging. Now, we all know about the pharmaceutical options that have been helping for 20 years plus now, but for some, these treatments, well, for whatever reason, side effects, or they just don't want to use medication, and sometimes it's just a temporary solution that may become ineffective. That is where Gains Wave may be a great option. G-A-I-N-S Wave. Gains Wave is a breakthrough shockwave treatment. I interviewed one of the practitioners, and I was impressed. He was deeply moved by the profound effect he had had through using Gains Wave techniques. It addresses what is at the root cause, a buildup of arterial microplaque in the penis. The buildup can impede the blood flow necessary for a sustained erection. Well, the Gains Wave treatment uses sound wave to break up that microplaque and improve or restore blood flow. It is non-invasive. It is drug-free. It is very comfortable. It doesn't hurt. Just takes about 20 minutes, and most men are able to enjoy the benefits the same day. If that's not good enough, there's even more. Gains Wave reports a 75% success rate. Impressive. So if you think you or your partner could benefit from the treatment, check it out. There are over 400 Gains Wave providers in North America. So to learn more, go to drdrew.com/wave. That is drdrew.com/WAVE. Go there today. Go now. drdrew.com/wave. You know, as a result of reading getting deep in that Grant biography, I've become obsessed with Frederick Douglass.
Me too.
Have you read his new biography?
I have.
What did you think of that?
I thought it was good. Not as good as the Grant biography.
No, a little long. Yeah, it wasn't written as well, but filled with lots of interesting stuff.
Let me ask you, it didn't seem like Frederick Douglass was a great father.
No.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think he's
– Because of his traumatic childhood. He was so traumatized. Are you kidding?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's alluded to in the biography, but he doesn't – he's not psychologically – the author is not psychologically sophisticated enough to really flush it out. I mean – he can't – how could he have relationships?
Sure.
It was amazing he had as many as he did that were as rich as they were.
Yeah,
From my standpoint, I was like amazed that he was –
that's a great point.
You know, he was able to sort of maintain things. And as always, the trauma comes through to your kids.
Okay.
It comes through to your kids. Oh. And so he – even though he was amazingly composed and this unbelievably phenomenal human – he abandoned his kids for the most part because, you know, he was working all the time. He was on the road saving slavery, you know, saving billions of people.
And his wife seemed like, you know, she's an uneducated, overwhelmed woman.
He treated her in not good ways.
Right.
But the only way he knew how.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not excusing it. I'm explaining it.
Sure.
And by the way, in spite of – I'm painting it a little too bleakly.
Yeah.
In spite of that – he bestowed tons of really rich time and energy on his family.
Yes.
He really did.
Yeah.
It's just he was saving the world.
Yeah.
He was. And when people do that, they often forsake their family.
Yeah.
And then if you add to that the trauma that he went through, oh my God.
There's an argument that he should be like on Mount Rushmore, that he's like a second founder of this country.
Not only that, I think he's the penultimate American.
I think so.
It's the only truly American, you know,
it is an amazing,
pure spun American experience.
It's an amazing American story. I mean, you have this guy born into slavery. Thomas Sowell has this great line. He's like, the books, like when they give Frederick Douglass's books to kids, like in schools, they have to put footnotes that like explain what some of the words mean. Mm. And he's like, here's a man who taught himself to read under the threat of whipping or death.
Yeah.
And he has a greater vocabulary than rich private school kids in New York City.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, his use and command of language was
Incredible.
Astonishing.
Incredible.
Like, whoa. This is like – it's like a great musician. He's like – he's born with something and he went after it and educated himself.
Yeah. And I mean just one of the great scenes in all of – it deserves to be in movies and tell it. This guy just decides one day I'm not going to be whipped anymore. And he just beats the shit out of his slave owner. And it's such a brutal fight that it's almost like, you know, the slave owner is like, I don't like this but I respect you. Just do your work. And Frederick Douglass is like, okay, I'll do the work, but I'm going to, you know, quietly plot my escape. And that's what he does.
Yeah.
And just an incredible human being. Also backs the right for women to vote. Like incredible. Like he wasn't one of those guys who was like hypocritical. Like
right.
He was – he really got it.
He also – he was not a stoic in a real sense.
Probably not.
But he he certainly would have embraced it if he'd understood it or been interested in it. But he also reframed my understanding of something that we don't have the right language for it yet, but he called it white supremacy.
Yeah.
And called Lincoln a white supremacist. And
yes.
In the opening chapters, I was like, what? I was stunned by that. And then I was convinced of it.
Yeah. And at the same time, was pragmatic enough to understand that Lincoln was an ally and that they could work together and get stuff done. He wasn't afraid to call him out.
He needs to work away from
this
thing that they're all infected by, which is white supremacy.
Yeah. It's like Frederick Douglass and Lincoln have a relationship not unlike Seneca, Marcus Aurelius
–
Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus.
Yeah.
But you could also argue it's a similar relationship to Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson, which is like this guy has the power. He's at least disposed to think somewhat kindly of my people and what I'm trying to accomplish, and we are going to work together. Whereas like now – we are incapable of understanding how political change is done. Mm. You know, like just the idea in the political debates that Joe Biden is having to answer for the fact that he was friendly with some racist Democrats like 40 fucking years ago is bananas. Do you know how civil rights was passed in this country? Lyndon Johnson was friends with all the segregationist Southerners. He tricked them into making him president and then he betrayed all of them.
Yeah.
Like that's how – that wasn't – it's not 100 years ago. Like some of those people are still alive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
yes.
We live in the world. We live in a world where imperfect people can, under the right situation, under the right pressure, with the right prodding and the right inspiration, may be made to do life-changing, wonderful things.
And by the way, it's not about them espousing perfect philosophy, perfect positions. It's about changing them slowly.
What do they do?
Compromise with them, getting them to come to the table.
I wrote this piece a couple weeks ago about how anger is the problem, not the solution, and that we think political change comes from anger, and it doesn't. Like that, you think when you read that book about Frederick Douglass, you read it about Grant, you see all these angry people. Like slavery was a great evil, and abolitionists were very angry about it. But you know who wasn't really angry? It was Lincoln. Like Lincoln was sad about slavery.
He was mobilized by it. He was moved to action.
Yes. He believed it was unconscionable.
I feel weirdly that way these days about things like homelessness and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, there's certain things going on in our country that like, I have to do something. I have to do it. That was him.
When
they overthrew the Missouri Compromise, he was like, I have to do something. This is ridiculous.
Well, there's this moment in Lincoln's life. He's getting off a riverboat and he sees a guy leading a chain of slaves. And he says like fish on a trot line. And this is this moment where he goes, this is awful. He doesn't, I'm so angry. And he frees the slaves right there. He wages a multi-decade campaign to go from there to where he ends up.
Right. Because his original position was put it on the course to natural extinction.
Yes.
So he was going to allow it to live amongst us as long as was necessary.
I mean, he talks about colonization.
He explored everything. He was a big proponent of Liberia and stuff, but you could call that all evil.
Yeah.
You could.
Yeah.
Because it was.
Right.
But he was trying to solve something that looked like it couldn't get solved without killing millions of people, but was willing to kill millions of people to get it solved ultimately.
Yeah. And one of the things I was saying in the piece is like, okay, look, here's why anger doesn't work. Most people do not believe most people do not believe the wrong thing and are not doing the wrong thing because they are evil, right? They are doing – just like when I was a kid, I grew up, I did not think gay marriage was a good thing because that's what I heard from my parents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I think differently. I wasn't evil. I was just wrong,
right?
And so I don't – if I don't see myself as being evil for having wrong beliefs in the past, how can I say that other people are evil for thinking the wrong thing now? Right. And so if they're not being evil on purpose, yelling at them is very unlikely to convince them of anything.
Right.
Being angry is not going to. And then for the actual evil people in the world, and there are many evil people, right?
Yes.
Some of them are currently serving in various political offices, right? Those people are way too dangerous to be dealt with in anger. They are not angry. They are strategic.
Yeah.
You don't yell at a sociopath to get them to change.
No.
You have to be
Nobody changes that way, by the
way. Right.
That we sort of live in a world where sort of what happens on a television show like Dr. Phil's show or somebody who yells at people, that's going to change that. And people believe that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, no. That just puts people's barriers up. And they are very unlikely to respond to that. No matter how hard you push, they just go on defensive immediately.
Yeah.
And you know, we used to say in treatment, we just go barriers up. As soon as they put the barriers up, that's it. You can't get through to them.
Yeah.
Just with sick people, what you do is just go, it's something called therapeutic wonderment. I wonder, answer. You go, I wonder why you did that. I wonder what that would be. What would motivate that? I wonder what that is.
And that requires restraint, requires empathy,
requires
patience.
Wisdom too, just to know that you can't get, you cannot, if your goal is to affect change, anger is not going to do it.
Yes, right. And someone like Martin Luther King, someone like Abraham Lincoln, someone like Lyndon Johnson, the people who affected the major changes of our times did so with strategy. They did so with compromise. They did so collaborating with morally imperfect people.
Now that I think about it, when anger does create change or it usually does it in ways that are not just messy but problematic.
Yeah, there's usually blowback or unintended consequences.
Look at the Bastille and what happened and cutting off the king's head and stuff. It's like
Everything
that followed started with that.
You compare the American Revolution to the French Revolution. One is driven much more by anger and resentment. Mm-hmm. The other about a sort of positive vision for a different alternative.
Absolutely. I never thought about that, but that's true.
Yeah.
One is trying to build a country around a principle. The other is trying to – really, it's acting out.
Yes.
And then – they have some good ideas they're trying to put in place that they do through totalitarianism.
Yeah, and eventually become susceptible to real totalitarianism.
And then they eat themselves.
Yes.
And that's it.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, listen, always great to talk to you. I didn't expect to go down the history path, but I hope people understand that how a conversation in Stoics gets us there.
And that these are the questions you should be thinking about and wrestling with, and this is what will make the world a better place, not what's Mueller's testimony going to be.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But back to leading a good life and doing what's right, if you don't study your history, it makes it harder to know where you are.
Yes.
And what's right and what's not. You really got to have a historical sweep to kind of help guide you.
And that'll calm you down because you'll realize what's happening in the news has happened before. But I also think it allows you – you know, when you look at someone like Washington or Grant or Lyndon Johnson or John F. Kennedy or these complicated figures, because they're not the president right now and you don't have strong opinions about the issues they're dealing with, you're able to learn from them and be a little bit more dispassionate than you are when you're looking at what – you know, it's like
– Well, in fact, I get – you know, I don't get that upset by what's happening these days because I keep thinking to myself, history is so complicated. I don't know if it's good or bad or how it's going to play out. I don't know. I mean, I don't like it, but, you know, I don't know. And the one thing, somebody we did not get into today, if we could have, that I've been thinking lately is if I was around in 1901, I don't think I'd like Teddy Roosevelt. I don't think I like him at all.
Most smart people did not like Theodore Roosevelt.
He was manic. He was narcissistic. He was impulsive. He was power hungry. He did when he was commissioner of police in New York, he ran around just beating people up in the middle of the night. I would have hated that.
Yeah.
I would have thought the guy was nuts.
Created a fake war with Spain for no reason.
Bought battleships whenever he wanted to without consulting with anybody, let alone the American public. Really wild stuff that would have scared the hell out of me.
And he did. People thought he was like an animal.
He was. Yeah. But in my reading, until I started thinking about it this way, he was my favorite president.
Well, so when we met for the
he was a stoic.
When we met for the first time, you told me to read Epictetus, and you told me you were reading The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt by Edmund Morris, which I read and totally loved.
It was before Hamilton and Grant. So it was really my favorite biography.
Yeah.
It is
amazing.
Beautiful. And I was totally enraptured by it and stuck and swept in. And then Theodore Rex was the one that followed that.
Yes.
And then I read a bunch of other ones about him and was taken by him.
I think
thinking about what it'd be like to live in that. I wouldn't have done.
And I think a lot of that was sort of like alcoholic-y energy from his face. Like he was a dry drunk in the sense of like
he was bipolar. Don't make any mistake.
But his brother committed suicide.
His son committed suicide.
There was darkness there.
Oh, bad. It was mental illness. Yeah. He was mentally ill.
Yeah.
I mean, he was.
Yeah.
Good for history.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That's the way it goes. So
he was a mentally ill person with a very strong set of principles and duty that that energy was mostly channeled towards positive ends.
Thankfully.
Yes.
Could have spun out at any time. But he was one thing about him, I think, very smart dude. Super smart.
Maybe the smartest president we've ever had.
I suspect in that zone. And that helped him a lot. And he well educated himself too.
He only wrote 38 books.
I know.
You're like, what?
And one was a natural history book by the time he was 18 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he had that guiding him, thank God.
Yeah.
And that helped, you know, that sometimes people like that are very manic. They just are.
Yeah.
That's how they're able to do all that stuff. They've got the engine going at a super high pitch.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen, man, come back anytime. Always great to talk to you. Everybody go get Stillness is the Key. And if you haven't read all of Ryan's other books, go get them. You can pre-order Stillness on Amazon right now. It's out October 1st. And Daily Stoic Podcast, available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Ryan Holiday, just like it sounds, .net, and at Ryan Holiday on Twitter. Anything else we need to pump out there?
No, thank you.
Great. See you next time.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's DRDREW Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.